Yeah, I'm just start. Oh, sweet. Oh, the timer's even going down because I started talking. Okay, I'm Glenn Condren. I work on the Entity Framework team at Microsoft, which is part of the Azure Developer Experience group now, under Scott Hunter, who was talking earlier about all of our grand plans for things. Today we're talking about Entity Framework. I'm going to go through the agenda real quick. So what I'm going to talk about today, first of all, is open source. Entity Framework is completely open source now, Entity Framework 6. Developed in the open, you can go get the code, you can look at it, you can make contributions to the code, you can see everything that we do. We're going to talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about the developer workflows. For those of you who have not used Entity Framework at all before, that's probably fairly new to you. Some of you will know it all. But it's definitely worth going through it because there's often a few common misconceptions that helps clear up. I'm just going to talk to a list of new features that we added in Entity Framework just briefly, and then we're just going to do demos pretty much for the rest of the whole talk, just talking about going through a few of the major features and showing you how they work. Okay? So, open source. At entityframework.codeplex.com, this URL here, you can get the Entity Framework source code. Basically, at Entity Framework 5 time, we took the code that we had and we moved it to an open source code base, which is hosted there, uses Git. But it's not just the source code. You can also get nightly builds. In fact, I'm going to use yesterday's nightly build in my demos today. Hopefully it'll go all right. We've got issue tracking, we've got feature specs, design meeting notes. All of that information is all publicly available all the time. Every week we do a design meeting and we publish those fairly detailed design meeting notes every week to the Codeplex website. In fact, I've got one here I can show you. So these are the design meeting notes from May 16th, just because we're mostly fixing bugs at the moment, so we haven't done that much interesting design-wise since then. And as you can see, we go into a fair amount of detail. We talk here about our time formats for logging. We've got talking about potential breaking changes. We're talking about the converting our own conventions to lightweight conventions. So there's a fairly large amount of detail. If you want to sort of feel like you want to keep tabs on how we're going with our new features and the design of Entity Framework, that's the best way to do it. We also publish feature specs, or we also call them one pages, the goal of which is to basically document our plans for a particular feature. As the name kind of says, we usually aim for about a page in length. This is our async spec. And we just go into a bit of detail here. We give some sample code and how things should work and what we are going to do and what we're not going to do. And then we try and update this. We do update them as we go, not always as we make changes. Sometimes these are behind the nightly builds and then we get updates to this as we go, but they're usually very, very close to what you can get from the nightly build. So if you want to know how a particular feature works that's still under development, this is the place to go find that sort of information. You're not likely to find it on our MSDN site or anything like that because we haven't released it yet. But if you want to try it out on a nightly build, you can come here and see how it works. And you can ask questions and stuff as well. We've got the discussions over here where the development team answer posts on here. So you'll get, Entity Framework lead of dev answering your questions if you're going to talk here. Or if you decide you've got some design question you want to talk about. So if you were going to contribute to Entity Framework, this would be the place to start talking about your contribution before you start working out the design or anything like that. This is where you would want to go. Okay. Now, so accepting contributions, some of the things we get from people out, and not just Entity Framework, sort of the web stack as a whole, because we've open sourced a lot of our stuff, SignalR, MVC, for example, is people are worried about some companies, some organizations are worried about open source software and the impact of having contributions to the open source software that's released by Microsoft is. So the way that it works is that only people on the EF team have commit rights to the repository. You can create a fork, your own copy of the repository. You can make changes to that as much as you want, and you can build and do whatever you want with the source code, but it's not released by us. And then if you want to make a change, you will submit a pull request to us. One of our developers will do a code review the same as every other code check-in that goes. So the way the Entity Framework team works is that no code gets into the repository until it's been reviewed by at least one other developer on the team. And your code, if you were going to contribute to Entity Framework, would go through the same process. Then there would be a discussion, backwards and forwards, you fix it, please write some unit tests, something like that. Okay, and then you then, if everything's good, then it will get accepted. Then one of our team members will contribute it on your behalf. It will still have your name on the in the repository. It'll say, you know, contributed by your username on, like, contributed by the EF team member on behalf of, you know, your name. But you can't just change it however much you feel like it. So far we have got a number of contributions. These numbers are out of date. There's at least one more contribution that was accepted by a new contributor, which means all those numbers go up by one. I think there may even be another one since I looked at it since then too. So lots of active stuff. There's been some great features added by our community members. Unai just there's added a couple of great ones. And I'll talk about a few of those, call out some of those that were added by the community versus added by the team as we go through. So the big important thing here, particularly for those people who are concerned about having the open source product in their commercial application and probably closed source commercial application, is it only affects how we develop, not how we ship. So when we ship Entity Framework, it still has the same license it's always had by Microsoft. It still has the same support agreement that Microsoft has always given it. And the code still has to adhere to the same quality standards that we have always had enforced. So all it is if you can write good quality unit-tested code and you think you could submit some of that to Entity Framework to fix something or to add some feature that everybody agrees is a good idea, you can do that. Even if it's not necessarily on our roadmap just yet. But if we think it's a good idea, we'll say, well, okay. Of course, we do reserve the right to say that's not really the direction we want to take Entity Framework, and we're not going to do that for you today, but that's okay. Okay, so developer workflows. Entity Framework, there's a few ways you can use Entity Framework, and this can cause some confusion when people first start out, and there's also some common misconceptions for people that have been using Entity Framework for a while. What it breaks down to is one of a couple of questions. The first one is, are you talking to a new database? Are you creating a new database for this application? Or are you trying to map your application to an existing database? You probably don't have much control over this. It's really just whether or not you're greenfields or brownfields or what your application is. Then after that, though, there is a question that you do have some control over, and that is, do you prefer a visual designer-centric approach to working with boxes and lines, or do you prefer code? And you want just code, show me the code. Okay, so if you prefer the designer-centric world, then you can use model first. This is where you create your model. You drag your boxes onto the lines. You design the way that your model will look for your application. And then you generate a database from that model. And EF takes care of mapping all of that for you. The other way is with an existing database, you can reverse engineer one of those designer models from an existing database. And we'll create the model and generate the code for you. Then there's code first to a new model. This is the one that everybody sort of knows of with code first, which is you define your standard class, your person class, then you may also have some special mapping code or let it map to a database by conventions, and then code first, the first time you run your application, just automatically creates your database for you. Now, this last box here is one that the common misconception, which is you can use code first to talk to an existing database. Just because code first can create a new database when you run doesn't mean that it has to. If you want to create some code first, create a class, define some mapping that you know will map to the existing database, you can just give code first your connection string and it will connect to that database, so long as the mappings work. There is also some tooling with the EF Power Tools, which you can get from the VS Gallery, where they will allow you to reverse engineer an existing Go database to a code first model rather than a designer model. Okay. So that's our developer workflows. So what's new in Entity Framework 6? So some of the major features that are here is async, query and save, which a fair few people have asked me about and are really interested in. We're going to show a little bit of that today. There's also a talk that I'm going to do on Friday that is focused on ASP.NET but just talks about async. So that's also, if you're interested in async in general, probably should come to that as well. It's connection resiliency, which is your ability to, when you're connecting to a database over an unreliable connection, you get transient failures, where your connection maybe goes away for a second, or you're connecting to SQL Azure and you've been throttled or something like that. Connection resiliency will allow you, EF, to automatically retry those transient connections so that you don't have to write your own retry logic. Code-based configuration is the ability to write just to configure EF, all the same stuff you can do in your web config, but you can do it in sort of a strongly typed API. That's the direction the code-based config is doing. Then database command interception and logging. These features we're showing all of these features, I believe, other than performance improvements. But database command interception and logging, there's now a really easy hook point for you to just to dump all the SQL out that any framework is generating. You can dump it out to wherever you want without using SQL Profiler. He's smiling. That's fantastic. Okay, there's also command interception where you can actually get hold of the DB command just before it hits the database. And you can, for example, even change the command text before it hits the database if you really wanted to. You can sort of play around with those lower level abilities pretty easily, which is cool for those who need to do that. It was very difficult before. And there's a heap of performance improvements, including at least one that was contributed by a community member, which significantly increases the warm-up time of Entity Framework. So all of those features were code first and the designer. These features are only code first, which is custom conventions and stored proc support for code first. Stored proc support is only for code first because it already was in the designer before EF6, so you could use it, you could use the procs in the model before. Now you can use them in code first as well. And custom conventions, in code first, there's a lot of conventions which will map your classes to your tables, like my table name is my class name. And if that's the case, you don't have to do any extra code to configure it. So now we have the ability to write your own conventions in a fairly nice API, which allows you to define configuration for a whole set. If you've written the same line of code to configure the key of every single entity in your domain before, this custom conventions is what you really want. So what else is new? I'm not really going to talk about these, but it's just an example of a bunch of the other features that we're adding in. And also, these are features that were added by contributions from community members. So the ability to plug different pluralization services into Entity Frameworks and improve performance, the add from assembly method for configurations. So there's a whole lot of features that we're not going to necessarily talk about much today that are added as well. You should go check out the feature specs and some of our release Webster documentation if you want to dig into more of it. So now it's time for the EF6 demos. I showed you this diagram before. The demos that I'm going to show you today are from this box, which is code first to a new database. However, I believe most of the features will work in both scenarios, other than the code first only features that we talked about. I'm just showing them in code first because it's much easier to demo them, really, than in code first than it is in the designer. Okay, so let's jump straight in to our first demo. Now, I'm going to go file new project and just create a new console application. What should I call it? I'm going to call it TechEd, unless somebody objects. I do have a bunch of snippets for some of the sort of repetitive code, so you don't have to see me type. But otherwise, all of this is just from file new. Now, first thing I want to do, package manager console, we need to install package entity framework. Now, I'm also going to add the -pre tag, which all of you put your hand up, when I said who's used NuGet, so hopefully none of that's new to you. This is actually the nightly build for Entity Framework 6.26.24, so it's a day old, rather than the actual official beta. So some of the APIs that I am going to show you today have changed since we released our last beta, which means some of the names have changed and some of the features were actually added, like logging is only added since then. So if you want to do all the stuff I show you today, go grab a nightly, because the last beta won't work for you. Now, we're going to add a new class. We're going to add model.cs. And I'm going to, rather than type in all my model, here's one we prepared earlier. And it's a model that you may have seen before. It has a blog, and a blog has many posts. And then we have a post, and a post has many comments. And a comment has a single status, maybe awaiting moderation. For example, might be an example of a status for your comment. Now, the other thing, this is code first, so that's all we've done. We have this key attribute because by convention, Entity Framework expects this property here to be called ID or blog ID, and that's not what they are, they're called key. So we've got this key attribute to tell Entity Framework that that's our primary key, and that's there because I'll show you how to remove it with custom conventions later on. After that, we need a context. So we'll create blogging context. Now, from here, this is This inherits from DB context. This is our derive DB context, derive context, or DB context. This represents your session with a database. And the way that you do that is you make some DB sets. And this is how we will query the database, how we will save changes. We will add new entities to this, to the context, and then save them, and that'll write off to the database. Okay. Some of you haven't used Entity Framework before, but hopefully this will become okay as we go through. After this, we need to do some database stuff. So we're going to do some database stuff. And this is fairly simple. All we're going to do is we create a new instance of that blogging context that we just created. We're going to add a new blog to the context with a number at the end. Then we're going to save it. And then after that, we're going to select all the blogs out, and we're going to write them out to the console. So it's fairly standard. So then we'll just call this from here. And then we'll throw in a console.read line so I can actually talk about what's on the screen. Okay. And then we should just be able to run it. So at this point, it takes a little while. It takes a little while because at the moment what Entity Framework is doing is it's going away and it's saying, I don't have a database. I probably should do something about that. I'm going to go create a database for you, and I'm going to set everything up, and then I'm going to create all the tables for the model that you you've defined. The model that we've defined is all of our classes that we specified over here, and Entity Framework knows about them because it could go and find out, because it's using a context and it knows what DB sets you've got in your context. So it's able to know what your code first model is, and it's able to go and create tables for everything. If we go over and have a look, by default, since I didn't tell Entity Framework anything, it's going to look on my machine, it's going to say, local DB is here, I'm going to go create a database on local DB, and I'm going to call it the same name as my context. So it'll do this for you if you're experimenting or if you're just trying to stuff out. If you've got SQL Express on your machine, it'll use SQL Express rather than local DB. If you can't find your database, that might be why. So if we look in here, we'll have our tables, and then it's just by convention again decided that what each one should be. And in this case, it's the plural of whatever the class name was, all of the defaults. Now, one other table that you can see here, for those of you who have used CodeFirst and migrations in the past, this is something that's new. Underscore migrations history used to be a system table, and it's not anymore. So you may not have even realized this was here, or you at least not have seen it so obviously before, but now it's just here. Okay. So, Entity Framework has created our database for us. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to enable migrations. So, you do that in the Package Manager console. Now, this is going to create this migrations folder for us over here. And it's going to create this configuration.cs class that you can see here. This is the same pretty much before, except that you can now it's got this context key. For those of you who have been using migrations, this wouldn't have been here before. It's a new feature that allows you to use two different completely separate code first models against the same database differentiated by a context key. So that just defaults to the name of your context, and so you should just be able to kind of use that. But if you need a special to set it to anything else, that'll be in here. And it also scaffolded for us a migration which will do what we've already done to the database, which is create all of those tables that I just showed you a minute ago. Okay. It knows that that's what our model looks like, and it knows that's what the database is there. So if we actually went and looked in our migrations history table now, there'd be an entry for that migration because it's already been done. Okay. Now, so to give you a brief primer on migrations, what we can do now is let's go over here to our blog class. Let's create public integer rank rating. Let's call it a rating. And then we're going to rate all of our blogs. Okay? So now our model is different to our database. If I was to run this now, we'd get an exception because it would say the classes that you've got don't match the tables anymore. And I don't know what to do with this rating field that you've got in here. And if you put any data in it, it's not going to save. So we can't really make a decision. So what we do here is then we can go add migration. And we'll call this add ranking or something like that. And this is going to look at our model. And then it's going to look at the model that we had from our last migration, and it's going to say, what's the difference between those two? Let's scaffold up some code here to update the database so that it'll match this new model that we've got here. So this is just adding a rating column to this table. Now, this is all just scaffolded code. It's not designed to be rerun over and over again and keep updating based on your model. It's designed to be sort of run. Then you can edit it. You can freely edit this and do whatever you want with it and then update your database. So, for example, Entity Framework doesn't care about what the default value of this thing is going to be. But you might. So you might set the default value here, for example, to 3. And that'll create the default value in the database, but Entity Framework doesn't need to know about that outside of this migration, so it doesn't care. So then we can go and update our database. And we can go look. And if we look in blog, we've now got a rating column. So just in case your DBA says, you know what, I don't really want you to connect Visual Studio to your production database server in order to do my migration, you can also go update database-script, which will generate a SQL script. You could also use, there's a migrations.exe, so you can use that and use the assembly and it will update your database. You can also use this dash script option. As you can see, that generated an empty SQL script, and it's done that because there are no differences between my data. I've run all migrations against my database. However, one of the new features that we just added in Entity Framework 6 is that you can go update database dash script, and you can go dash target source migration even, and you can go dollar initial database. And then it will scaffold something. And the reason it scaffolds something, what it scaffolds here is different to what you may have expected. That's the change that we just made. So it is going to, if you specify the source migration as the initial database, what you actually get is a SQL script which will take your database from any previous version up to the current version. So it does checks in this SQL to say, has this migration already been run? If not, to run this SQL. Previously, if you'd have done dash script from source, it would have just given you SQL that would have ran regardless of whether or not the migrations were in the table. So now you can say, generate me one whole script, and that'll be able to rerun, and regardless of where the version's at, which is nice for some people, especially if you've got a few data, especially if you've got a few environments that are maybe at different versions, and you want to sort of have one script, and it can be used at any on any of those databases to upgrade all of them to the latest version. So this will generate that for you, whereas before, you would have had to generate separate scripts to update from each version to each other version. Okay. So now, after that, I think that's our primer on migrations and our basic application. Hopefully those of you who haven't used Entity Framework got a bit of an idea. So now we're going to talk a little bit about custom code first conventions. It is an ability to bulk configure entities and properties. Those of you who've used the Fluent API before, you can use the conventions to do most of the things you can do in the Fluent API, but against a set of objects and properties instead of just a single one. We built it to avoid situations like in the model that I've got just here that I'm going to show you in a minute, where, as an example, maybe your DBA has said, just ID is not good enough for your primary keys. Your primary keys need to be something that does not match one of our conventions, like key, for example. If all of your primary keys have to be key, then previously to Entity Framework 6, you would have had to write a separate piece of mapping for every one of those keys or put an attribute on every one of those keys to say this is the primary key. And it's the same, if anything just doesn't match our conventions, then that's when you want to use this, where you've got a convention that doesn't match ours. Or if you just don't like the default conventions, if you just prefer your things, your primary keys to be called key, then this will be the much easier way to get around that. So we're going to have a quick look at that. The way that you use conventions is the same way that you would use the Fluent API, for those of you who have used this before. So you override your on-model creating. And the way that you would use this right now is you would go model builder. So I should go back and give you the example. So in this model that we have here, as I said earlier, we're giving this key attribute. So if I remove this key attribute from all of these entities here, and then I try and run my model, my application even, this is where we'll get that exception that I talked about earlier, which says that it cannot define a key. If it can't find a key for any of these because it only has a set number of conventions that it knows about, and you haven't told it anything to help it. So now, in the current way of doing it, you can either put the key attribute in like we just shown, or you could come in here into Model Builder, and you can go modelbuilder.entity, and you can get your blog entity, and then you could go dot has key, and you can say the key property is the key. And then that will work for blog. but then you'd have to duplicate this piece for all the other entities in your model. So now in Entity Framework 6, what you can do is you can say model builder.configure all properties in my model. And if the property's name is key, then configure it to be the key. And that now configures my whole model so that any property called key anywhere in my entire domain, Entity Framework will try and use as the primary key. Okay? And then you can override that with specific configuration. And what did I do wrong? Oh, I didn't do this. That's a method. Okay. So now that's the this is your convention. So now we should be able to run our application and it'll work again because now it knows where the keys are because we told it just then in our convention. Okay? So there's a few other things that conventions can allow you to do. Some of the other things that people like to do is maybe not do just that, is if you have a naming convention which doesn't sort of match our naming conventions, then what you can do is I've just created this method, and what it does is it accepts reflection information for the property. Now, just here in this where clause, you have this P is the reflection of the information for the type. So it's your property info class, which is what this method's accepting. Inside configure here, this config is a class which has methods on it with all of the configuration things you can do. It's very loosely typed compared to the Fluent API in that it will allow you sometimes to call things that may not... If you could define a set where some of those things support like is Unicode and some of those things don't support is Unicode, then you can just call is Unicode in there and for a few of those properties where it makes sense, it will just sort of ignore those no up calls. Other times where it doesn't make sense, we will throw. So there are situations where we will throw if you do that, and some situations where it's okay, we'll let you do it, where mostly based upon whether or not we could make a valid call on what that happens. But originally we never threw at all, and I think now we've changed that, so we throw in a number of situations that are just obviously invalid. And then, yes, that's... I think generally, though, it works pretty well, and you can kind of do everything you try and do. But we're going to accept that property information here, and what this method does is exactly what this comment does here. So it will return, based on the property that we'll give it, it will return us a string which has the type name, and then an underscore, and then the property name, and it's going to all be lowercase. So by default, it's going to all of our properties in the database, all of our columns are going to be Pascal case, and they're not going to have the type name in front of them. So over here, after we write this convention, what we should see here is that our name column here will be called blog underscore name, and it'll be all lowercase, for example. There are some people that like to use this type of convention. If you're not one of them, that's okay. I'm not saying that you have to do it. So from here, we're going to go model builder.properties again. This time we don't want to where, because we want to just talk to every single column in our database. It wants to be the same thing. So we're going to configure it. And then this class, as I said earlier, is our configuration. So we can't just pass it in, but we can go config.hasColumnName. And then we need to pass the hasColumnName method a string which represents the column name for this property. So now we're going to call this method, which is going to derive a string that this column name should be based off our property info. And we exposed the property info on config as CLR property info for whatever property that you're configuring. If you were looking at entities here, that would be the type information for the type rather than the properties. And I'll show you one of those conventions later on. So now, if I put enough close brackets into our thing, or maybe too many. Perhaps I should read error messages. Because I neglected to actually call the method that gives us back a string. That's why I thought I had not enough round brackets. Okay, so that will now configure our database to have all of our lowercase with underscore column names. The problem with now this, though, as you may imagine, causes a database change, which means we want a migration to be able to reflect that change so we can make it later. So let's say new column names, and then add migration, not migrations. I'm just typoing everywhere today. Okay, so now We have scaffolded us a migration to rename every column in our database to match our convention that we just wrote. So we'll go ahead and update database. And that will change all of our column names to reflect what our convention should be. So now we have blog underscore name, blog underscore URL, and so on and so forth. Now, for those of you who have used this before, and if you would have had to specify that mapping for every column of your database, for every column in your model individually, one after another, probably with just a hard-coded string, would have been kind of painful. If any of you are in a situation like that, you're definitely going to appreciate this. Now, after that, there's one other thing we might want to do, and that might be, let's look at maybe some data types. Let's go properties of type string. So over here, when we were looking at our model earlier, notice that by default, if you specify a string, we're going to match that to nvarchar. Now, you might think that's a little bit excessive. My DBAs always tell me that I should have much smaller string types than that in my database. So what we might do is say all of our properties of type string, and this generic will just only call configure for everything that is of type string. So it's like going where property.type equals string. It's just a shortcut for that. We're going to configure, and we're going to say has max length, and we're going to set, let's say, 200. Okay, and we'll build. And then, once again, this causes a database change. So we're going to add migration max length. It's going to scaffold us up another migration, which is going to change our, this changes our max length for all of our string columns. And then we're going to update the database again. And now, if we go and look at our database, instead of having max, we've got a string of 200. Now, specific configuration will override more generic configuration like conventions, which means you can set that type of convention and say every string is 200, and then if you've got specific columns that you do need to be text, you can write one line of code just for them to say this string is text instead of 200. So you can do these sorts of things where you can say, in general, all of my strings match this, and then these few specific strings. So you can reverse, whereas before you would have had to write code to specify every string, now you can write some conventions for whichever is the most common case, in special case the ones that require the least amount of code, which is nice. Okay, now what we're going to let's switch back to our slides. We're going to talk about database command logging. This allows you to log every seek command or query that is sent to the database, which is what command logging probably should do. It's an easy way to see what's happening without doing something like spinning up SQL Management Studio and SQL Profiler. Right? That's currently the way you would see the SQL as it goes to the database. You would use SQL Profiler. But for those of you who don't know why you would want to do that, if you want to know why the SQL is wrong or why your database is performing badly or debugging unexpected data coming back or those sorts of general, I don't know what's going on, I don't understand why Entity Framework is doing what it's doing, I want to see the SQL, because if I have some SQL, if I have a link query and then I can see some SQL, I can kind of just make some get more informed decisions about where I think the problem is and what's happening here. So it's also possibly a general learning tool as well, in terms of learning the sorts of things that any framework does. You can see the SQL that's being generated all the time, and you can start to understand more about how everything works. So in order to use this, the easiest way to do it is to go to our context, there is a database property, and on the database property, there is a log property, and it accepts an action of string. Luckily for us, sorry, I don't need a lambda symbol there. I've got too many lambdas everywhere. Console.write is an action of string, which means that now if I run our application, it will write all of the SQL out to the console. For those of you who have been using SQL Query Profiler, you might like this. There's at least a few of you that are smiling pretty heavily at the moment. So a few of the things that you can see here. This is our insert command just here. And if I go back, that might make it easier to see. From here, this is our query. Okay, and some of the things you might see here, we're calling out, these are the parameters that we actually passed into that query. This is how long the query took to execute. This is the date time that it took. This is what the result type was. So you give you a fair amount of information. It's also not just logging your queries. You're also going to see other queries that Entity Framework make on your behalf, like this query here, which is querying the migrations history table early on in the process. Okay, and if they're taking a long time, maybe you need to know that, or something like that. Okay, now that's pretty much it for logging.
What about the results?
The results. It doesn't show you. It doesn't log the results out. We can in the hooks that we're going to talk about later. You can see the results, but normally you would look at your results in your application when you got your results back. So we didn't really. It doesn't log every result. Okay. So the next thing that we'll talk about, luckily, as if by magic, that feature there makes the next feature very much easier to demo, which is that stored proc, code first stored proc mapping. So this allows you to configure your application to, instead of generating SQL, to call stored procedures that you defined. We built it because some people like stored procedures. And if you're in an organization that likes stored procedures, it's very, very difficult to change their mind. So you should use it if you're... Okay, you need to use it if you're mapping... Someone said yes, did they? You use it if you're mapping to an existing database with stored procedures, or if your business mandates the use of stored procedures, or there are a few other reasons, like where Entity Framework just can't map to your schema. You have some crazy table structure. You can't work out how to get the mapping to work, but you can write a stored procedure that saves this entity for you. So you write a stored procedure, and you just get Entity Framework to call the stored procedure. Right. That's probably fairly rare, but you may also need other changes you can do that is just best to be done on the server. Maybe an audit log, for example, which we'll show an example of in the demos. So how do we do it? We do it in the same place where we were configuring our other stuff over here. So to begin with, let's look at our Fluent API and let's match entity. Let's look at our blog entity, and we can now, in this here, the new method we have is map to stored procedures. Now, there's two overloads of this. One of them is blank, and the other accepts a bunch of lambdas to be able to configure what the stored procedure should look like. So that's where, if you just leave a blank, like we are going to do here for our first example at least, it's just going to, by convention, decide what it thinks the stored procedure should look like. Okay. So right now, what we've done here is we've told Entity Framework the blog entity is going to be loaded from a stored procedure. I want you to work out what that stored procedure should be called and what properties we should pass to it. And so it's going to assume things like blog underscore insert and stuff like that. Now, the problem with that is we don't have a stored procedure that matches what Entity Framework thinks it's going to be. So we need to go add migration, blogsproc. And then Entity Framework is going to scaffold a stored procedure for us. So this create stored procedure method here is going to create what Entity Framework would do if it wasn't doing stored procedures, basically. And it's going to create this statement, and when we update our database here, it's going to create a stored procedure called blog insert. It's going to accept these parameters, and it's going to call these commands. Okay, so this is your starting point to convert your model over to stored procedures, is that this will give you the ability just to scaffold them all out. You've got a nice starting point, and then you can customize them or tweak them as you need to, or not if you don't need to. And it creates us insert, update, and delete are the stored procs that you can map to. And it'll create scaffold us up one of each of those. So now if we update our database, if I select the console, and we come over here to our programmability tab, we should see our three stored procs. And if we run our application, we'll see that the output from the log has now changed. So this log bit that we looked at earlier where we were doing the insert, now it's just saying we just called log insert and whatever it does is what we've done here. But we don't know what that is because it's on the database server. But we still tell you what it was that we passed in to the stored procedure. So you can see what the output values were. Okay. Now, if you want to customize that output, then we can say, okay, I want to configure my sprocs, and we're going to configure the insert sproc, and I'm going to configure it to be called. So there's a few methods on here that you can configure. Effectively, anything that you could do to control how EF maps to that stored sproc. This is mostly important for the I'm mapping to existing database, or I have a really stringent naming convention on all of the stuff that my stored procs are. So from here we can say we're going to call this, I don't know, maybe it's called create blog instead of blog underscore insert. And let's do something else. Let's say our parameter that we created earlier, that one that we added by migration, let's say rating, it's going to be called blog score in the stored procedure instead of the default, which is just the name of the property. So this now is saying we're going to map to this stored procedure called create blog instead of blog underscore insert, and the rating parameter, instead of matching that by convention to have a property called rating, we're going to have it called blog score instead. Now this causes some database changes as well. So let's add migration. Let's call it blog sproc custom or something. If I called it the same thing as the other blog sproc, it would have just added a number to the end. Now, this has scaffolded us a rename stored procedure and an alter stored procedure. So if we execute this code now, it's just going to rename the stored procedure to what we want, what we said here, and it's going to do an alter stored procedure command to change the property, the parameter. Now, I mentioned earlier that this stuff is really scaffolded, not... So there's a distinction between scaffold and generated in that scaffolded code we intend for you to sort of modify and change, and generated code perhaps we want to keep generating it and don't mess with it. This is definitely scaffolded code. So one of the things we could do here is, let's say we create a blog creation log. Now, this create table statement here is going to create a table called blog creation log, with a key, a created by, and a created date, the key being its primary key. Now, this table isn't part of my model, and it doesn't have to be part of my model. Migrations can do lots of things to the database that the model doesn't necessarily represent. So we're going to do a create table here. And this insert statement, which is part of this snippet, it inserts a value into that table. So we're going to go down here, and just after we've inserted to the database and we've gotten our key, we're just going to insert into the blog creation log. So now, every time Entity Framework creates a blog for you, we're going to also have a corresponding entity in our blog creation log, and that's going to be taken care of under the covers without actually the surface, your API surface, reflecting that. So now, one of the things that I really like about this anyway is that I've just enabled audit logging without changing the intent of my code and the expressiveness of the code, readability. I don't need to know that audit logging exists necessarily to be able to change my surface ABI. That may be nice or not nice depending on how you feel. Personally, I really like it. It also, the other thing that's important about this is at this point, I could deny write permissions to my blog table to users and allow access to the stored procedures. So now I have a situation where nobody can write to the blog table except for the create stored procedure, and if you use the create stored procedure, it inserts automatically into the audit log. So now nobody can create a blog without it having an entry in your blog in your audit log table. Hopefully your audit log table will also have some permissions changed, otherwise it might not be so useful. But that's a feature that's really good. So if we update our database now, it'll execute our migrations. And then if we come over here, we'll see that our create blog stored procedure name is different because it's executed this SQL. And we've also got this table, blog creation log. And if we run this, we'll see that we've called create blog instead of whatever it was that we had before, blog underscore insert, probably. And we have also, if we come in here and have a look, we've also got an entry in our log table, because I just created a blog. So those of you who are in the situation that need that sort of functionality, that sort of behavior, then this gives you the ability to do that fairly nicely. The last thing that stored procs works really nice with, and that I thought was very impressive, was that you can combine two features we've talked about today. You could combine conventions with mapping to stored procedures. So we can say modelbuilder.types. Now, types is you have two top-level APIs for conventions, properties and types. We looked at properties before. Types means I'm going to configure every class in my model, every entity. Not necessarily entities, otherwise it would be called entities. They could also be complex types for some of the configurations you can do here. But that's beside the point. For now, we're going to say, so every type in my model, I'm going to configure it, and I'm going to map every type in my model to stored procedures, whatever the convention stored procedures is. And now I can go add migration. Everyone loves procs. And hit enter. And now we scaffolded create, update, and delete procs for every type in my domain. And if I go and update database, then it'll create all of those procs on my database, and the next time I run my application, any creates, inserts, or deletes that I do will all use my sproc layer instead of generated SQL. Okay? If we go over here and have a look, now my stored procedures thing is much more full. One thing that's important to note is that create blog is still called create blog, even though I define my blog stored map to stored proc with its customizations here, and then I'm using this convention to map everything to the generic stored procs. Specific configuration wins over more generic configuration. So you have sort of a layered approach where you have entity framework, default conventions, your custom conventions, attributes, and then your Fluent API, so that you can override specific parts of the conventions, whether they're your conventions or our conventions or however you want to do it, whatever gives you the most flexibility. Okay. Enough with stored procs. Hopefully everybody who said they were here for stored procs was satisfied by that much of it so far. Next thing we want to talk about is another feature that lots of people have asked us for, which is async query and save. In .NET, the .NET framework, they added support for async with the await and async keywords in .NET 4.5. How many of you are familiar with it, with async? Excellent, most of you. So, We added support for this. The reason we added support for it is because using async can significantly improve perf and scalability of your applications if used correctly. I say appropriate use there because if used incorrectly, it won't do anything and may even hurt your performance. So if you come to my talk on Friday, if you want to know about how you can make async really kill your server or make your server really good, you could double the throughput of your web server or halve it, maybe. So use it when you want to free up resources on, say, a web server where you're using ASP.NET, or improve client UI responsiveness where you've got your Windows Forms application and you want your UI thread to continue whilst your database work is happening, those sorts of scenarios. You can also do a little bit of parallelism, but you can't execute two queries on the same context at the same time. So you can use parallelism, but not at the same time. Okay, let's talk about it a little bit. So in our program.cs, we're going to do a few things. We add the async keyword. We're going to change void to task. Okay, and then I'm not going to dwell too much on this because most of you said you're reasonably familiar with this, but I'm going to take the task return type of create and print blogs. And then I'm going to go down here. This isn't really asynchronous, but since it's just a console app, I'm just going to wait on it. Wait's blocking. So if you're trying to do async all the way, don't use task.wait. Use when all or something like that. So task.create print and blogs, and then down here inside create and print blogs, I'm going to say to list, and I'm going to change this to to list async. Basically, Entity Framework has an async version of any operation that would have caused a call to the database to happen, which is to list, save changes, anything that's going to cause the data, cause you to actually connect to the database, there'll be an async version for. You're not, however, going to find an async version of like where or add, because they are just operations on your context. They're not operations that actually talk to the database. and which means if they're not I/O bound, then async is not that valuable. Now, the reason that I have this error here is the first thing that everybody who tries to use async to find, which is that the majority of them are implemented as extension methods in system.data.entity. And most of the time, you don't have system.data.entity by default in the location where you're writing your code. Same problem as system.link had, except we just added system.link to every file you ever create to monitor to resolve that problem. So to-list async now works if we build. And if we run, what we'll see now is that we do our create blog and everything is cool, everything is fine, right? So what we really want to do here is we want to install package. That's the extent of how it takes to do async, but in order to show some async in action, I've got this quote of the day package on my local machine, and it just allows me to go console.write quote of the day dot quote dot get quote. It's terribly complicated. And what it does is goes and gets a string and writes it out to the screen, which means that now what we can see here is that we do our select here. You can see how it's do our select. Then the quote displays, and then it writes out all the blogs. But if we look at our code, we write out the quote of the day here, and we write out the blog stuff here. And yet, our get quote wrote out to this console before our for each loop here. And that's because when we awaited on the database operation, we've gone back, we've taken execution, has come back to our main method, it's written out the console whilst we were doing the data operation, and then it's hit the task.wait, which waited for the rest of it to complete, and then continued on. Okay? So this is how we can start adding it in. And we can go with some more async, because save changes also has an async method. So we can say db.save changes async here, and we'll just await on that. And now if we run our application, we'll get a bit of a different output. Now it's going to do the quote of the day, and then it's going to end up doing our select because it actually got the chance to write out our console.write whilst it was doing the insert operation instead of whilst it was doing the select query. Right. So async can be a little bit confusing, but you can ask me about it at the end if you want, or come to the other async talks that are all over the place. That's our whirlwind tour, just to show you that it exists in a new framework now. Now, the next thing we want to talk about is code-based configuration. Code-based configuration is a code-centric alternative to using the Entity Framework sections in your web and app configs. Some people just love using code and hate writing XML. They prefer a nice strongly typed API sometimes. And you should basically use it if you prefer strongly typed code over writing XML. However, it is particularly advantageous if you're using something like an IOC container, for example, to change switch configurations, because you can do it, and you can't really do that with XML. And we expose a lot of, we expose most of the stuff that you can do. Now, there's two main ways to do this. I am going to demo this in a minute, but I wanted to spend a little bit of time before I demoed it to talk about it. There's two main ways, there's two things that we added for DB configuration. The first is you just create a class that inherits from DB configuration inside the same assembly as your context, and then Entity Framework will find it, and it will do whatever you say inside the constructor of that configuration class. Now, that's how we expect sort of 95% of people to do the code-based configuration. It's simple, fairly discoverable. However, a lot of the methods that you're going to see are really implemented with this with a dependency resolver mechanism that we added, which actually allows you to add your own resolvers to replace services that Entity Framework uses, like pluralization service. So you can, if you need to, use these lower-level dependency resolver API to replace different bits and pieces of functionality that Entity Framework has. There's sugar methods for those that are most for the in DB configuration to allow you to do that easily, but you could also use dependency resolver if you're like a provider writer or somebody who's doing some fairly low-level EF stuff and you want to replace some of the innards of it. Okay, let's have a look at it. So over here in our class, we need to have a new class, and we're going to call it blogging config. Vonfig. I could call it blogging vonfig, but we'll call it config since that's what I said. Now, our blogging config, as I said earlier, it needs to inherit from DB configuration. which is in our system.entity.config. And then we need a constructor. That one was a built-in one. It's not one of my own snippets. So public blogging config, we can go this, dot. And this are all the things that we can set and we can change. There's a bunch of services. We're going to show a few of these today, execution strategies and such. Now, the one that I'm going to look at first is pluralization. So here, we can say set pluralization service. Now, one of the things that Entity Framework does, as some of you may have noticed, is that if we go to our model class here and we have a look at our database explorer, again, our class name is called blog, but our table name is called blogs, plural of blog. Now, so it's used this pluralization service to do that. Unfortunately, the plural of status is statuses, not status. This is a bug in the Entity Framework pluralization service, which gives me the opportunity to show you. For those of you who don't speak English, the pluralization service basically doesn't work. So if you want to have a model with a non-English pluralization, you really, really want to be able to replace the pluralization service. So what we're going to do is, since statuses is the plural of status, we're going to create our own pluralization service that handles that. And since we've been doing lessons on English, we're going to create a more better English pluralization service. And it implements iPluralization service. And for the most part, it just defers to what our default English pluralization service does. But in this, for this demo, we've just special case status. So anything that ends with status, we're just going to tack a yes on the end because of statuses. Okay? And then up here, we're going to add a new, more better English pluralization service. And that, as you probably have guessed, was going to cause a database change. So we got add migration, more better English. Okay, and then we have now scaffolded up our code that renames status to statuses. And everybody is much more happy with the world. So we go update database just to apply those changes, and we're good. Now we've got a statuses table instead of a status table, which if you have any particularly pedantic people on your team, you'll make you very happy. Now, it'll also make you actually follow your naming conventions, which is probably a good thing. The next thing that I want to talk about, though, is I show you a little bit of some of the lower level hooks, and also do something a little bit more interesting with logging. So I'm going to install package nlog.config. Right. So familiar with nlog? Yes? No? No. Okay. So nlog is just a logging library that you can use. It's fairly configurable. Now, what I'm actually going to do, one of the options that you can do here is add interceptor. Now, what it allows you to do is add this IDB interceptors. Now, a DB interceptor will actually intercept every DB command just before it goes to the database, just before when it's executed, so on and so forth. So what I'm actually going to do here is create an nlog interceptor. And what it's going to do is it's going to implement IDB interceptor, and it's going to get an instance of nlog here, and it's going to log stuff to wherever nlog is configured to log to every time there's a query executed. And then if there was an error when it was executed, it's also going to write warn instead of just trace. So it's fairly basic. It's not particularly interesting at the moment, but that's okay. And then over here in our config, we're going to go this dot add interceptor, new nlog interception. Okay. Now, what this is going to do, the last thing I can do is over here in nlog.config, what you actually have is a config file which controls, you know, what level of error am I logging, where am I logging it to. Nlog has a bunch of options for like logging to the event log or logging to a database, logging to text files, rolling text files, things like that. So now I've built an interceptor so that it's going to go to nlog whenever queries are executed, and by config I can change when and where that goes to, based maybe in production or if I need to be able to debug something in production or whatever I'm going to do. So this is just a different way of doing this sort of behavior. If I run this now, then nothing's going to be any different to last time, except that over in our, where we built this, in our bin, there's going to be a logs file, and it's going to have a text log, and it's going to have traced all the queries as they came through. Now, whilst that's interesting, it doesn't talk about everything that this thing can do. So just here in executing, I could actually modify the command text before it hits the database. For example, I could go like command text dot add command text with raise error on the end, and then cause every single error, every single query that entity framework generates to throw an exception. Anything that I wanted to. If I could determine what the result of a query should be here, I could return the result without ever hitting the database. So if I set this interception context as a result, so if I set interception context.result here, that will just get returned and there will be no database call. And then the framework will trust that you know what you're doing. So it's not really the correct place to implement like a second level cache, but you might be able to do some caching of your own there if you really want to. Okay. Now, that is all. How much time have we got left? Okay. So I'll just show you one other thing, or a couple of other things that's pretty cool with here. So one of the other things that you can do here in blogging config is we can go set execution strategy, or maybe it is add execution strategy. So one of the other features that I talked about earlier on was the ability to automatically retry transient errors. So one of the ways that you can do that is right here. We can set a factory method, which is going to be new SQL Azure execution strategy. Okay, and then that's in the system.data. It's in the SQL Server provider because it's specific to SQL Server, so it's not in our default entity framework stuff. Now, what this line here does is that whenever an exception gets thrown when we run a query against the database, if that exception ID is in a list of known exception IDs that we know are transient, EF will automatically retry. And it does that based upon, it uses an exponential retry policy, which just means that the first one it retries instantly, and then after that it gets longer and longer until the max retries run out. And you can configure some of that here, or you could write your own SQL execution, you could write your own execution strategy, there's a base execution strategy that you can derive from, which will do most of the work for you, or you could just implement IDB execution strategy yourself. So there's a bunch of stuff that this does. And it also works quite well. We won't be able to see it, but I could over here in redirection, you can go context, I could go command.commandText equals string.format. This probably isn't a good idea, but let's try it anyway. And we're going to go command.commandText. And then what we're doing here is we're taking every query that comes in, and we're just going to tack some SQL onto the end. And we're going to tack raise error. And we're going to raise error, I wrote this down in case I've done this, 40501, which I happen to know is an exception that we retry on. And we're going to raise it as like that, I believe, is the correct syntax. And now everything's going to crash because I have incorrect SQL syntax because the 18 and the 1 are around the wrong way. Are any of you that already knew that and were just waiting for everything to explode? Should I just close it? No. So these are the... and I didn't close the bracket either. Cool. So now what you'll see is the same query. So you see it executed really quickly the first few times, and then our exponential retry policy is starting to kick in. So the first couple happened really quickly, and now it's trying to execute the same thing over and over again with a longer delay in between each time. And eventually the max retries will run out and it'll fail because I didn't put anything in to stop raising the error, so it's just going to eventually die. But it shows you that the retry policy is actually doing something. Okay, and you can configure some of that in there, and it's okay. It's particularly nice, the execution strategies when working with cloud-based database providers, which happen to do things like throttle you and move your database server around and things like that. Web and app config always wins over any of the stuff that I just showed you. So if you deploy code-based configuration, you can always change the web config in production to do something that you need to change or whatever you need to do. Okay. So what's next? Vote. If you want to go to ef.mswish.net is our userverse site. You can vote on things that you want to see in Entity Framework there. You can learn about Entity Framework at mscn.com/data/ef. Except you won't be able to learn about any of the things that I've showed you today because we haven't released them yet. So to learn about them, you need to go to entityframework.codeplex.com. And if you want to contribute, go to entityframework.codeplex.com. There's also at entityframework.codeplex.com is the issues database. So you can log, you can vote on issues, which is any of our bugs or feature requests or anything like that. We track almost the entirety of our work, possibly the entirety of what we're going to be working on in the near future in that issue database on Entity Framework on Codeplex. So if you want to go do that, there's Twitter, there's EF Magic Unicorns and Facebook Magic Unicorns. And I'm going to finish up there with about 8 minutes to go. Typically Entity Framework questions get fairly involved, so I'm leaving some extra time for people to come and talk to me because it usually takes 5 minutes to describe the problem before I can or to describe what's going on. So feel free to come up and talk to me. But also, I'm also going to be on booth duty a couple of times later on in the week. And fill out evals. They're really important for us and for TechEd so that we know what content to display next time. If you really love this EF talk, you want to see more like it, fill out your evals saying that it was a good talk. If you don't want to see any Entity Framework, that's the alternative. Hopefully you'll say that it was good. Thank you very much.